Mas Cohen, welcome to Radio Times. Prisoners at the U.S. detention camp at Guantanamo Bay have been on a hunger strike to protest their treatment and the uncertainty about their future. Almost 100 of them have been okayed for release but have no place to go. The first act of President Obama in 2009 was the signing of an executive order to close Guantanamo within the year. It's a promise he says he still supports, even though the Pentagon has asked for money for new construction on the site, and even though he has faced stiff resistance from Republicans and Democrats in Congress and the states. Today on Radio Times, we want to get an update on Guantanamo. Then we'll be talking about the future of the detention facility. We begin our conversation with Carol Rosenberg, and she's been writing about Guantanamo for the Miami Herald. And Carol, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning, Marty.
How many prisoners are on a hunger strike? Do you know?
Depends who you ask. There's 166 captives down there, and the military says as of this morning that 39 are on a hunger strike. So we're talking about edging up towards about a quarter of the prisoners. The lawyers for the detainees who've been getting phone calls and who have met with a slice of them, a few lawyers have met with a few detainees, say that the compliance with the hunger strike is much higher. They're saying it's like virtually everybody in the camps where the people are slated for release, at least, is participating in the hunger strike. The good news is the Red Cross is down there, and they're building up to a 12-member delegation. And while they may not make public the figures, they should be able to get some real, you know, strong sense of what's going on down there.
And why the hunger strike? Why are they on strike?
Well, both sides agree that this is about frustration, that this is, you know, they're in their 12th year down there, and a number of these people were told as far back as the Bush administration that they would be moving on either home, perhaps to lockups in their own countries or to supervised release in their own countries, or that they would be finding them third countries to help resettle them because of the stigma of having done time at Guantanamo. And there's tremendous frustration that the Obama administration hasn't been able to make, you know, good on this pledge to close it, and hasn't been able to move out any of the cleared people for over a year. Now, the detainees say there's one other problem. They say there was a particularly aggressive shakedown of the communal camp back in February that, in their perception, involved disrespect of the Quran. And the Quran has always been a flashpoint for tensions down there, and so it is the perception of the prisoners that something went wrong in searches of the Quran back in February. The military calls it nonsense, but it seems that this, you know, tension over the Quran is fueling it, and neither side seems to have a suggestion for how to back away from this, except that the prisoners would like to turn in their Korans.
Well, there has been a change in the military command at Guantanamo. Does that in any way explain why there might be some changes down there?
Well, that's the key to understanding what goes on in that prison. You know, the prisoners have been there year after year after year, and every year MPs or sailors come in and do their tour of guard duty. They show up for a year. They, you know, it's their ticket punch in the war on terror. They walk the blocks. They work on the camps, and then they leave. And so what you have, as has been explained, is a learning curve. They come in and they start from scratch, and then they leave. And I think that we can't say this specific group has particularly been given new instructions, but the culture, the climate down there has definitely changed since I was back there, down there back in August for Ramadan. It was much more of a feeling of detente. The commanders of the camps made it clear that they understood these men. Some of them should have been released long ago, and there was a certain sensitivity. Basically, the guards down there, they're kind of frustrated with this hunger strike. They think they've been made to look bad. They think it's not their fault. And at this point, you know, like I said, the culture is very bad on both sides.
And what has been the response to the hunger strike at Guantanamo? Are prisoners being put into the hospital? Are they being force-fed? What has been the response so far?
Well, there's a lot of churning going on. You know, they've got a camp for communal prisoners. They've got a maximum security camp. They've got a psych ward. They've got a hospital. And it's clear that they're moving people out of the communal camp into single-cell lockdown. They're moving people, not many, to the hospital. And of the 39 that the military acknowledges are hunger strikers, 11 are currently being fed by tubes. It's not pleasant. There's a dispute over whether the detainees resist. The military says at this point the detainees know it's inevitable, so they sit quietly while a tube is tethered, you know, is snaked up their nose into the back of their throat, and they pump a can of insurance to keep them, you know, alive. Whether or not they go along with it, it's nothing that any sort of conscious person wants to have done to them.
Well, the International Committee of the Red Cross, based on some of your reporting, looks like they came to the facility about a week early, I guess, to assess what is going on. How much access do they have to the prisoners there at Guantanamo?
At this stage, the Red Cross doesn't complain about access, I'm told. I'm told that they get to see each and every one that they ask for. There was a period back in the early days when there was perhaps more than one force working and running the camps. When they did protest, we know through leaked documents that prisoners were hidden from them. I think that if the Red Cross were to answer questions, which they don't, they would be saying that they have a reasonable access. You know, they go pretty regularly. They sent a doctor and another worker down last week on a rush schedule, and they're adding another 10-12 delegates this week. It's not that the Red Cross are that popular down there, though. I mean, the Red Cross acknowledge in a statement that the frustration is about 90 of these detainees really should have been moved on a long time ago. And the Red Cross spokesman says that feeds the frustration and that they don't have anything to offer recommendations to the American government, to the Pentagon, that they get on with these parole hearings and try to clear some people out who they want to leave. I think you'll hear in the next segment why they can't go, and
sure,
it's politics and it's international instability in certain countries where they come from.
Now, I guess at the height of Guantanamo, when it had the most prisoners, there were, close to 700 prisoners back in 2003. And as you say today, Carol, there are something like 166. Have most of those people then, sounds like most of them have been released.
Yes. The Bush administration let about 500 go in big batches. The Saudis and other countries sent in airplanes and took them out in a dozen or more at a time in these big airlifts that left. When Obama came in, they were 500 fewer. And what they did is they tried to fashion individual solutions for individual detainees. By the time the Obama administration started, there was a recognition, certainly by the intelligence agencies, that these mass releases didn't allow countries and, again, the intelligence agencies to keep a tabs on people who had spent time at Guantanamo and left. Guilty or innocent, many of them left, you know, very angry that they were taken there in the first place.
And how many people at this point are facing trial? And we're obviously talking about Guantanamo prisoners. How many are facing trial?
Well, that's the interesting part.
Right.
There's six, Marty. There's only six of these men are being tried at the moment. All six of them are facing death penalty trials. Five of them are accused of organizing, masterminding, helping move the money to the 9/11 hijackers. So they're considered the 9/11 conspirators, including the man who is supposedly put together the whole plot, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. And then the other death penalty trial involves a man who supposedly organized the Al-Qaeda suicide attack on the USS Cole, the warship off Yemen in the year 2000. Now, maybe a dozen more would go on trial. Maybe. They're still trying to figure out some problems and inconsistencies with this war crimes trial system they've set up. They're still trying to figure out if conspiracy is really a crime and should be tried down there. And then there's three men down there, depending on how you look at it, who are convicts. One was convicted of being a videographer, a propagandist for Osama bin Laden and making a recruiting film. He was given a life sentence, but his conviction is a little bit up in the air at the moment. It seems like the government's going to withdraw it or has withdrawn it, depending on who interprets what the government has done in federal court. And so he's a convict, unconvict lifer. Mm. And then there's two other men down there who are being held, one who should be heading back to Sudan this year, which leads some people down there to believe the easiest way to get out of Guantanamo is to find some small crime to plead guilty to, get a short sentence, and go home. The other thing is I think you probably know, recently somebody went home who committed suicide, as the military says, committed suicide.
Right.
So it's become sort of a theory that another way to get out of Guantanamo, frankly, is to die.
Oh, gosh. Now, there are also, Carol, apparently 46 others who have been called by the Obama administration too dangerous to transfer but not feasible for prosecution, putting them into this legal limbo, it would seem.
Marty, those are the indefinite detainees. It's a category, can't try them, can't release them. And there were 48 of them when the Obama administration made a list, and two of them did die and got out. So now we're down to 46. Hmm. Those names have never been made public, but they're people who the administration believes either the prosecutions are too tainted or the evidence just isn't there to convict them even at their own war court. And so they're designated for endless war on terror detention, kind of like POWs in an ongoing war for which maybe there's never going to be an end.
And Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who you had just referred to, now he is on trial and charged with what?
Oh, he's charged with many things, from conspiracy to terrorism to attacking civilians to nearly 3,000 counts of murder. He's one of those five men who they are putting on trial for the September 11th attacks. It's going slowly. They had a start during the Bush administration, and they stopped to rewrite sort of the rules for the war court. Now it's getting back in, and they're still working out issues like whether he can have conversations with his, how he has conversations with his lawyers, how he prepares his defense. And for people who are watching this, I think it's really frustrating. Some months back, he won the right to wear a camouflage vest to court. So I don't think people who look at the 9/11 trial at Guantanamo is getting them speedy satisfaction or speedy justice are going to be very satisfied. He's there with his nephew and three other men. All of them get to Guantanamo in 2006. By then, they'd already thinned the prison. They'd already released lots of people that different Bush administration boards had decided shouldn't have been there in the first place. And they're kept in sort of a secret prison, a special lockup, for former CIA captives, people who had special things done to them, for example, waterboarding, and can't come in contact with other prisoners because they would, in fact, talk about what happened to them, which the Obama administration, like the Bush administration, considers a national security secret. What the CIA did to them back in their dark sites can't be said out loud, and we can't hear it in public.
All right, Carol, final question to you, about 30 seconds before we have to say goodbye. Is there construction going on at Guantanamo?
Oh, they've got a building boom going on. There's lots of plans to improve the quality of life, in particular for the guards. They want to get them out of the trailer park and into some barracks right next to the prison. They're building them a new chapel. The sequestration may be happening, but the Southern Command here is looking for a lot of money to do a lot of rebuilding.
Well, Carol Rosenberg, thank you for getting us started today as we discuss Guantanamo Bay. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And she has been writing about Guantanamo for the Miami Herald. The first of three guests in this hour of Radio Times. So we'll be taking a very short break. And then we have two guests waiting in the wings as we talk about the future of Guantanamo. And we'll be taking phone calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. The future of Guantanamo and the prisoners who are being held there. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Arcadia University Art Gallery in Glenside supports WHYY and presents a lecture on April 3rd that explores J.G. Ballard's dystopian science fiction work, The Voices of Time, featuring Arcadia professor and author Dr. Richard Wertheim, and held in conjunction with the gallery's exhibition J.G., a film project by Tacita Dean, on view through April 21st, open to the public with no ticket required. Information at gallery.arcadia.edu.
It's the most exciting moment in baseball, watching four players cross home plate in an epic grand slam.
And a drive to left field, down the line, it is gone! A grand slam home run!
In honor of baseball's opening day, we're celebrating musical grand slams. Four knockout albums in a row. Join us as we review the stats this week on Sound Opinions.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. Prokofiev wrote his Fifth Symphony as a hymn of hope for Russia and its people facing their greatest challenge. Conductor Jaap van Zweden leads the Philadelphia Orchestra in Prokofiev's Fifth and the music of Tchaikovsky, The Souvenir de Florence. Tickets at 215-893-1999 or at philorc.org. April 12th and 13th at the Kimmel Center, Tchaikovsky and Prokofiev with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. We just got an update on Guantanamo Bay, speaking with Carol Rosenberg from the Miami Herald. Joining us now is David Fracht. He's a visiting professor at the University of Pittsburgh Law School, a lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Air Force JAG Corps Reserves. He was also the lead defense counsel with the Office of Military Commissions, representing two detainees at Guantanamo who were facing war crimes and terrorism charges before the U.S. military commissions. And David Fracht, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. Also with us is Benjamin Wittes. He's a senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution and co-founded and is the editor-in-chief of the Lawfare blog. Benjamin Wittes, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
And I should say he's joining us from the ISDN studios at Brookings. David, if I could begin with you, and I'd just like your response to the hunger strike, having been someone who has represented prisoners held at Guantanamo Bay. What do you think the message of this hunger strike is?
Well, I think it's really a sign of the desperation of the detainees, particularly those who are cleared for release and are stuck at Guantanamo because of domestic U.S. politics. There may also have been some incidents of guard insensitivity or of detainee officials being insensitive, but you know that I don't think it would have gotten to this level if it were not for the fact that the detainees are starting to give up hope of ever being released.
Ben, do you see this as a serious sign of what's happening at Guantanamo?
I largely agree with.
I think it's very serious. I think, you know.
David, hold on. I'll get right back to you. That's okay. I just want to get Ben in on the conversation. Ben, your thoughts?
Oh, sure.
No, I largely agree with what David said. I mean, I think there's a real problem when the administration is not capable of effectuating the releases that and transfers that it authorizes. And, you know, the Obama administration came in with fairly grand plans with respect to the detainee population at Guantanamo. And it did some very serious work in reducing that population. But there is this group of people, mm-hmm. many of them Yemenis, whom it has cleared for release and for whom the situation in Yemen, the administration and more particularly Congress just do not want to be releasing people to Yemen right now. And Congress has gone a step further and said, don't want to be releasing people from Guantanamo at all unless you can make certain very rigorous certifications. And the result is that this process has really ground to a halt. And I think that does create a certain sense that, you know, the word release doesn't mean what the plain meaning language in English would suggest that it means. And I think that does contribute to a sense of desperation among the detainee population.
David Fracht, going back to you, but do you think there's something that the Obama administration should do and can do to essentially allow the release of these prisoners?
Well, right now, Congress has passed a series of very strict restrictions in the 2013 National Defense Authorization Act. President Obama threatened to veto that legislation because of these restrictions, and he's threatened that in the past two National Defense Authorization Acts. But at the last minute, he backed down and went ahead and signed it. The administration says, you know, we can't really afford to hold up the entire defense budget over this issue. But until he's willing to stand firm, his hands are largely tied because right now there's still the possibility of transferring detainees and resettling them in third countries, some of our European allies or South American countries that are stable and don't have a terrorism problem. But those countries have basically said, look, we're not going to help you solve your problem if you won't help yourself. If you're unwilling to resettle any detainees in your country, then it's very hard for us to, you know, sell to our population why we should take any more detainees. So there really is very little that the president can do, and that's why he actually, you know, he had a special envoy, Ambassador Daniel Freed, who was assigned with this task of finding countries willing to take detainees, and he was recently reassigned to other duties because it simply, he wasn't making any progress. He hadn't, for the last 2 years, there haven't been any. There were two, actually, that were sent to El Salvador, but there haven't been any others.
Well, Ben, do you see this as largely a political problem in that you've got both Republicans and Democrats in Congress who are resisting the release? And there have even been members of state legislatures and governors that say, we don't want these prisoners either.
So there's two problems. One of them is, as you say, political, and the other is situational. And it's worth actually disaggregating them. So the first problem is that a very large percentage of the remaining detainees at Guantanamo are Yemeni. And if you think about the original Guantanamo population, there were really three big populations. There were Saudis, there were Afghans, there were Yemenis. And those together constituted the bulk of the population. Now, the Saudis and the Afghans, we developed enough sort of good relations with at a functional level with those governments that we were able to repatriate people in large numbers to those countries. But Yemen's kind of a mess, and efforts to bulk repatriate large numbers of Yemenis have always run aground as a result of the situation on the ground in Yemen. And this bedeviled the Bush administration for a number of years. And the Obama administration sort of thought it had a solution to it. But then Mr. Abdel-Muttalib tried to bring down an airplane over Detroit, and there was a the whole situation with al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula arose, and the administration just announced that it was not prepared, it was going to sort of draw a moratorium on repatriating people to Yemen, and thus recreating this problem that, you know, you really can't address the Guantanamo population as a whole until you've addressed the Yemeni population. In addition to that problem, which is a problem, you know, it's fundamentally a conditions problem. There is a political problem, which is that a lot of people in Congress, and you're right to say that it's a bipartisan majority in Congress, it's both Republicans and Democrats, have a very little appetite for releasing people from Guantanamo. And the congressional transfer restrictions make it really difficult to remove people, including people who should be removed, frankly. And so there's really two problems, and they reinforce one another. One of them has a solution, which is that the president needs to stare down Congress about the transfer restrictions. And Professor Fracht alluded to some of the efforts that he's made and then backed off of to do that with respect to threatened vetoes of the NDAA. Mm. But one of the problems is a little bit more intractable, and the question of how the administration should think about, you know, a large number of Yemenis whom it does not want to be holding, but doesn't really want to join up with, you know, AQAP forces in Yemen, is actually a very hard question.
And I want to pick up on that, but let me go back to you, David Fracht, because you did defend two prisoners who were held at Guantanamo. One, Mohammed Jawad, that was a teenager, I guess, who was brought from Afghanistan, and also another prisoner as well. Were they both released? Were you able to get both of them released?
No. The first, Mohammed Jawad, who was about 14 or 15 when he was brought to Guantanamo, he was actually charged in the military commissions. I was able to get those charges dismissed, and he won his release through a habeas corpus petition in federal district court. and he was ordered released July 31st, 2009, and released about 3 weeks later. The other detainee that I represented, sort of, because he really rejected me as his lawyer, but he was the detainee that Carol Rosenberg referred to earlier in the program that was convicted. His name is Ali Hamza al-Balul. He received a life sentence, and his conviction for conspiracy, material support for terrorism, and solicitation were recently vacated by the Federal District Court, the Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit in Washington. That ruling has been appealed. They've requested an en banc review of the whole court, and probably will take that all the way to the Supreme Court, because the issue of whether conspiracy and whether material support to terrorism can be tried in the military commissions will really determine how many detainees can ultimately be put on trial there. Most of them that they are seeking to put on trial have not committed what we would consider traditional international war crimes, and really have committed these terrorist type of crimes. So that traditionally in the U.S. have been tried in federal court. And the Obama administration wanted to transfer detainees to be tried in federal court. They did transfer one detainee, Ahmed Gailani, who was tried and convicted in the Southern District of New York and received a life sentence. But Congress has also blocked any transfers to the United States, even for the purpose of prosecution in federal court. So, you know, Ali Hamza al-Balul's status is uncertain. He's also is a Yemeni, so even if the U.S. wanted to release him, which they don't, he would not be releasable right now.
And that's David Fracht, who joined us along with Benjamin Wittes. And we are talking about Guantanamo Bay, the 166 people who are being held there, what their future may be. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Ben, you have said that there are good reasons from your perspective to keep Guantanamo open. How come and how so?
Well, so, I've never been a particular advocate of either closing Guantanamo or retaining it. I mean, there are people who feel passionately on either side of that question. I'm not one of them. My view is that as long as you are going to detain outside of the criminal justice system under the authority of the laws of war some significant group of people, you have to do it somewhere. There has to be a location for that policy. And Guantanamo is as good a location for that as any other. Now, if the administration came in and wanted to get rid of Guantanamo, and I certainly have no objection to doing it somewhere else instead, but it does seem to me that the focus on the base, the focus on the question of where you do it rather than what it is you're doing, what the rules of it, what are the rules under which you do it? What rights are you giving to people in that process? Strikes me as a misplaced focus. And I would much rather have a debate about the question of whether we should and under what circumstances we should be continuing or not continuing to detain 166 people and more if you count those in Afghanistan than I would about the specific locations in which we're doing it.
David Fracht, let me get from you a response. Does it matter, do you think, where these detainees are being held, whether it's on Guantanamo or another location?
I think it matters a little bit. You know, Guantanamo is a symbol of internationally of a place where there were significant abuses of detainees. The images of the early days of Guantanamo of people living in what were essentially dog kennels, you know, still circulate around the internet, even though today's facilities are you know modern and appropriate. So that was the driving force behind President Obama's announcement back in 2009 that he wanted to close it for the symbolic value of a place that stood for maybe even torture, but certainly abuse an indefinite detention and an unfair trial system. The problem is that when President Obama embraced indefinite detention and embraced military commissions, albeit reformed ones, he created a necessity to have a Guantanamo somewhere, as Ben has pointed out. Mm-hmm. So, and Congress says, well, we've already spent hundreds of millions of dollars on this facility. Why should we authorize you to, you know, build a Guantanamo somewhere else, a Guantanamo North, for example, some people called the Thompson Correctional Facility in Illinois that the president had proposed moving detainees to. So I think at this point, Guantanamo is still a potent recruiting tool for terrorists. It makes the United States, certainly makes the president look weak that he is unable to bring about its closure, despite ordering that. I mean, it's hard to imagine if President Bush had said, it's an urgent national security priority to close Guantanamo, and I'm ordering it closed within a year, that Congress would have put up the kind of fight that they have with President Obama.
Well, let me go back to you, Ben. I mean, this is a big if, of course, but if the detainees were moved to some facility in the United States, let's say a supermax facility somewhere, would they have different rights once they were actually on domestic soil?
Broadly speaking, not. So the detainees at Guantanamo have a right to file habeas corpus cases, which, you know, they do, and those cases get litigated in the district court and the in Washington and the D.C. Circuit here. So that wouldn't change. There may be some availability of certain civil actions that they don't have access to now, but I think broadly speaking, most people think that that's not right. I mean, and so I think broadly speaking, the difference would be almost entirely symbolic unless, and this is an important unless, one were ordered released by a court and we were unable to effectuate that transfer, then you would have this question of whether that person would have to be released domestically. As long as they're at Guantanamo, that question is a lot less acute.
Well, and that reminds me, and we're almost up on a break here, David, but it does remind me of critics of moving Guantanamo to the U.S., the idea that we would have, you know, quote-unquote terrorists running around the streets.
Well, I think those kind of dangers are grossly exaggerated. Certainly no one has ever escaped from a maximum security prison, and it seems unlikely that a U.S. federal court would order the release of someone for whom there was, you know, strong evidence of involvement in terrorism plots. I should note that even though there is a habeas corpus right, that no detainee has won a release through habeas corpus in the last 3 years. So, the easier cases, there were several releases in 2008-2009, but those have trickled to a standstill now, so I think that's just irresponsible fear-mongering.
And that's David. Okay. Yeah, hold on one second, Ben, only because we have to take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Now, the voice you heard, David Fracht, visiting professor at the University of Pittsburgh Law School. Also with us, Ben Wittes. He's a senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution. Getting an update on Guantanamo Bay, the 166 detainees being held there. What should their future be? Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
The Chester County Historical Society supports WHYY and presents the 31st Annual Chester County Antiques Show, Friday, April 5th through Sunday, April 7th at the Phelps School in Malvern, PA. More than 50 exhibitors feature 18th and 19th century American and continental furniture, rugs, paintings, glass, silver, jewelry, needlework, and other decorative arts. Presented by PICO. For details on tickets, show hours, and sponsorship opportunities, 610-692-4800 or chestercohistorical.org.
Psychopaths, they lack conscience and empathy. Our prisons are filled with them, but not all psychopaths are in prison. And a debate continues between mental health professionals. Can they be treated, or should they be? On the next Voices in the Family with Dan Gottlieb, understanding the mind of the psychopath and learning from it. Today at noon, here on WHYY-FM.
The Fabric Workshop and Museum supports WHYY and presents Changing Scenes, Points of View in Contemporary Media Art, a history of independent film, video, and installation art from the 1970s to the present by artists Pepon Osorio, Namjoon Paik, Adrian Piper, Javier Tellez, and others. Reception Friday, April 5th, 6 to 8 p.m. Gallery talk by curator John G. Hanhart at 5:30. 215-561-8888 or fabricworkshopandmuseum.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen. Just a recap, on his very first day in office in January 2009, President Obama issued an executive order closing the U.S. detention facility at Guantanamo Bay within the year. Today, while there are fewer prisoners than there were in 2009, Guantanamo is still open, housing 166 prisoners, and about 90 or so have been cleared for release, but they have nowhere to go. Talking about all of this with David Fracht. He's a visiting professor at the University of Pittsburgh Law School. He represented two detainees and was a lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Air Force JAG Corps Reserve. Also with us, Ben Wittes. He's a senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution, co-founded and is the editor-in-chief of the Lawfare blog. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Do you give us a call? And Ben, I know you wanted to say something. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to amplify on what Professor Fracht said about there being no substantial security risk associated with bringing Guantanamo detainees for detention in the United States. I very much agree with that. I think there are arguments back and forth about whether Guantanamo or some facility in the United States is a preferable place to do this policy to the extent that you're going to do it. But I think the idea that you're going to have detainees running around the United States mm-hmm. is just silly and doesn't belong in the conversation.
But what's interesting, and I'm looking at a news story, a 43-year-old man from Saudi Arabia has been indicted in federal court in Brooklyn, will stand trial on charges that he plotted to kill U.S. military personnel in Afghanistan and U.S. diplomats in Nigeria, prosecutors said Wednesday afternoon, very recently. So clearly, Ben Wittes, and I'd like to hear from you, David Fracht, which is that current terror suspects, at least this one, was not taken to Guantanamo, but taken to a federal facility in Brooklyn. Ben?
Well, so the administration has a policy of not bringing new detainees to Guantanamo, and that's a flat policy. So mm-hmm. no new detainees have come to Guantanamo, I believe, since 2007 or 2008. In addition, this administration has a very strong preference for processing new cases in the civilian justice system and has a policy that it will not use military detention for either U.S. citizens arrested anywhere or anybody arrested within the within the United States itself. And so the new cases that come up all get routed through the criminal justice system, with the exception of with the exception of cases of foreigners abroad in combat theaters where we still do detain people.
David Fracht, do you want to weigh in on that? And I'm just curious, as someone who has represented detainees held at Guantanamo, what kind of rights do they have, and do you think they have enough legal protections as someone who has represented a detainee?
Well, when I was representing detainees, we were operating under the 2006 Military Commissions Act that has subsequently been revised with the 2009 Military Commissions Act, which is a substantial improvement. So the military commissions, as they stand currently, are very similar to the rights that detainees, suspects would have in a U.S. Federal criminal court or in a U.S. military court-martial. They're very similar, but not quite. There's some differences, and minor differences in the rules of evidence that make many critics feel that there's still a second-class justice system. Mm-hmm. And part of the problem is that the rules have to be made up, the procedural rules have to be made up as they go along, because Whereas in the federal court, you have longstanding system in place, and we've prosecuted over 500 terrorism criminals successfully since 9/11 in federal court. But in Guantanamo, we've only prosecuted seven, two through trial, five through guilty plea. All seven of those convictions are now in question because they all pled guilty to material support to terrorism, which has now been determined not to be a war crime. So there's just a great deal of uncertainty about the military commissions. They have proven to be very slow, very cumbersome, and it just has not been the quick and efficient justice system that President Bush envisioned when he originally proposed military commissions. So I think the rights in the military commissions are, you know, are reasonably good, but we're only talking about a very small handful of detainees that are planned to be prosecuted at all. Chief Prosecutor suggested that there is approximately 16 detainees that they plan to prosecute over the next 3 years in military commissions, including the six currently in pretrial proceedings. The Obama administration had said at one point that they were looking at about 36 that they wanted to prosecute either in military commissions or federal court. But the vast majority of detainees at Guantanamo will never see a day in court, at least in criminal court. Their only recourse is through habeas corpus, which right now, as I said, no one has been released for that for the past 3 years. The Obama administration was supposed to set up and promised to set up an administrative review process, a periodic review. They've been very slow in dragging their feet and getting that set up. It's taken 4 years. They're still not operational. So this is what's contributing to the sense of desperation of the detainees, that they just have no pathway, no opportunity to really have their day in court.
Well, and Ben Wittes, I'd be curious about what you make of the fact that the Obama administration, as I talked with Carol Rosenberg about, has determined that 46 of these detainees are, quote, too dangerous to transfer but not feasible for prosecution. What is their fate under these circumstances?
Well, so the 46 is actually more than 46. So let's break up the population for a minute. And you say, well, when the Obama administration came in, there was a group of people. They said, okay, we can repatriate these people. We can get rid of them. So a bunch of them went home. A bunch were sent to third countries that were willing to take them. There were about 60 Yemenis who, in principle, under some situations, the administration was willing to send back to Yemen, but then they stalled or declared a moratorium on repatriating people to Yemen. So that group is there, sort of stuck there. And then there were 35 people, as Professor Fracht said, who they envisioned bringing to trial, except that some of those people are never going to go to trial because of jurisdictional problems in the military commissions. And then after that, you have 48, now down to 46 people, who the administration says we can't bring to trial and we're never releasing.
Right.
So what we're going to do but that number, you'd have to add to that now the group of people who would have gone to trial but are not going to go to trial, as well as the Yemenis who would have been released but aren't going to be released because we're not repatriating people to Yemen. So there's really several groups of people who either officially or unofficially are kind of stuck there. And I think the answer has to be this periodic review mechanism that was announced, that policies for were announced, and that has never really gotten off the ground. And I think the only answer is to on a regular basis to review these cases and ask in a serious way, why are we still holding this person? What could we do other than hold this person? Is there some means short of detention that we can mitigate the danger that he poses? Does he still pose a danger? Is there any reason to think his attitudes and ambitions have changed? And some of those people over time, you may change your judgment about Some of them are going to be there for a long time.
Well, David Frack, just trying to imagine, of course, this, and I'm using quotation marks, this war on terror is not exactly like World War II, where the enemies sat down and signed a peace treaty. But assuming there is some kind of end to this war on terrorism, would that, do you think, then allow some of these detainees to be released? And I realize it's a very a question full of conjecture. Your thoughts?
Right. Well, there are two different armed conflicts going on right now. There's an armed conflict against the Taliban in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And, you know, the president has basically announced that we will be concluding that armed conflict in 2014. So there are a few detainees that are really Taliban detainees, and I think at that point it becomes very difficult to justify their continued detention under the law of war. I think they probably have to be returned. And then there is this larger war on terror, really war on Al-Qaeda and its affiliate organizations, and the question of how long that conflict will go on and how will we know when it's over is one of the most vexing ones that the administration is facing. I mean, being at war is not a normal state of affairs. We should be seeking to return to a state of peace. Many people, myself included, would like to see the struggle against Al-Qaeda and terrorism return to more of a criminal justice model. But, you know, that doesn't seem to be the preferred option right now. So I think as long as there is a plausible claim of an ongoing war on terror, that there will be people who wish to detain these individuals based on their dangerousness. And you know, there is a small handful of detainees who are very fanatical jihadists and very violently opposed to the United States and to the West in general. You know, one of the clients that I represented was like that. But I think the idea that everyone at Guantanamo is like that and that these are the worst of the worst, that's really a misconception. So we have very distinct groups of people, and we should be doing more at this point to try to release those who pose no threat, and then we'll have a smaller group that will have to work through this indefinite detention process.
Ben, I'm curious about whether you think the Obama administration's use of drone strikes, whether that, in a sense, continues the war against terrorism and then might have the effect of keeping people in Guantanamo.
Oh, well, so the two are actually quite closely related in the sense that the essential legal authority that the administration claims to conduct drone strikes is the authorization to use military force of September 18th, 2001. That document, which Congress passed in the wake of the September 11th attacks, is the same document that the administration claims as the source of its authority to detain people at Guantanamo. And so one of the questions is, you know, if you're the administration and you need that document to be a vital document and to be a current document for purposes of authorizing what is for you the central act in overseas counterterrorism, which is, you know, these strikes that we're conducting in several countries in the world, the byproduct of that argument is the assertion that the war is still ongoing, that the conflict that it authorizes is still ongoing, and therefore that the detentions that are done pursuant to that AUMF, to that authorization, are still lawful and still valid. Professor Frack makes an excellent point about the potential legal consequences of the disengagement in Afghanistan, that if you imagine, and I'm not sure how many of the detainees, I haven't looked recently, are Afghan Taliban with no alleged Al-Qaeda element. But, you know, once you're no longer engaged in combat in Afghanistan, it may become very difficult to justify the continued detention of such people.
And David, I'm just curious about your client, Mohammad Jawad, who was released from Guantanamo, I believe you said, in 2009. What is he doing? Where is he living? How is he doing?
Well, I wish I knew, Marty. You know,
really?
when we sent him home, we did give him a cell phone, and we kept in touch with him for a time to, you know, see how he was adjusting. He was the subject of some harassment from the Afghan security forces, was rearrested a couple of times. Actually, one time he, you know, met some former detainees at a cafe, maybe not the best judgment on his part, but was rounded up and arrested for that. So he decided to move back to Pakistan, where he had spent some of his youth, and we've really lost track of him since then. So I really don't know how he's doing. There was a story about him in GQ a year or two ago, and the author had tracked him down, and you know, he was doing all right, but we really lost track of him.
Well, we do have to end our discussion. My thanks to both of you for joining us today in Radio Times. David Fracht, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
And
thank you.
You're welcome. He's from the University of Pittsburgh Law School, and he did represent two Guantanamo detainees. And Benjamin Wittes, thank you very much as well.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And he's from the Brookings Institution. We began our conversation with Carol Rosenberg, and she has been covering Guantanamo for the Miami Herald. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program, including Facebook, Twitter, email, archives, podcasts. 1-888-477-9499. That's the phone number to use coming up in the second hour of Radio Time. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Coming up next on Radio.